But I have a feeling for a lot of people, the darkness I experienced on that night is going to be what they see of the change. And frankly, I think there's going to be a total breakdown of economic structures. I think that a lot of people are going to go mad, I think, with fear.
So I've been looking over the material you sent me, and boy, there's a lot of different threads. And you know, as always, talking about Whitley Strieber, and especially given my own early, you know, kind of 1990s fascination with them and with aliens and UFOs and all of that, I'm always tempted to like focus in on that part of the story that you're telling, but there's all this other stuff that's interesting too.
Well, I think, like, so far anyway, there's been much less focus on Strieber and aliens than on the other stuff,
right?
That's how,
right,
with our last conversation. So yeah, don't be shy about zeroing in on that, because eventually we're gonna have to.
Okay, well, I guess I wanted to talk about just your, at the end of the third chapter that you sent me, you suggested that you thought there was a socio-political agenda, which is using a combination of traditional beliefs, I'm reading it to you, with newly created ones or new arrangements and interpretations of old ones for the creation of a scientistic religion. And that reminded me of what people will talk about sometimes, Project Bluebeam.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me a pretty straightforward kind of conspiracy theory that you're suggesting. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't seem necessarily follow from all the kind of the rigor that you've put forward, you know, in terms of thinking about trauma and before that. So,
okay. Well, I don't think it is a straightforward conspiracy theory. I don't think it's a conspiracy theory at all, really. It might sound like that, mm-hmm, when I sum it up in that way. Is that a question?
Yeah, is it? What do you think? Go on and tell me why I'm misinterpreting it. You know, why is it, do you think it's not something that's being consciously done? That there's no group of like there's no secret society that's has this as an agenda, but that it's some sort of unconscious.
I don't think they're that secret. I think what the new wrinkle in this, for me at least, who has done, as you probably know, lots of research and theorizing around secret groups and secret agendas and all of that stuff. I mean, I've had an interest in it for a long time. I've always tried to approach it in a more holistic fashion. But I've still... I mean, one thing I became aware of while working on this present thing is that despite that attempt on my part to see it holistically, I've still had this tendency to split it into good guys and bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think what's different in what I'm seeing now is that really literally is not possible, and that the agenda of creating these memes, although it might be being to some extent directed and formulated by specific groups like the Stanford Research Institute, is the one that I cited at the beginning, of Changing Images of Man, and the individuals associated with that, Willis Harmon, etc. And how that kind of, if you take it in one direction, that seems to intersect with MK Ultra and the mind control programs and the application, the appliance of trauma in order to access psychic powers or whatever else is going on in that whole field of thing, but which is very obviously shady and unethical and conspiracy related.
Mm-hmm.
But if you follow it in the other direction, it very quickly overlaps with creative influences that I've been influenced by and admired, such as Aldous Huxley or Carlos Castaneda or Whitley Strieber or any number of them. And so at that point, it becomes impossible to separate the good guys from the bad guys, or to extricate like individuals who appear to be independent agents following their own trail of clues and doing their own creative imagination and hypothesizing and all the rest of it, and coming up with seemingly independent and creative works from those agendas. And I think that there's even within that there's an overlap. So somebody like Huxley and indeed Strieber, possibly if we look into their past enough, we probably find that they are affiliated with groups to some extent. And Willis Harmon, Stanford Research Institute, I mean, he's obviously very closely affiliated with some sort of social engineering, but not necessarily in a negative way. I would say that although there is a conspiracy element, it's part of a much larger picture, which can't be reduced to groups or agencies or agendas unless one takes it to like a collective unconscious agenda, which is has different layers of consciousness, and some layers or some branches of it are operating consciously or are conscious of certain aspects, other areas are conscious of other aspects and unconscious of others. It's all like this great kind of ball of twine.
Yeah. Well, I have a question about, well, I have kind of a thought about what you just said. One is that I don't know if I would want to even divide up the good guys and the bad guys, even if everyone's a mixture of good and bad, and even if the motivations can't be clearly parsed out, and even if the affiliations are kind of muddy as well, because people with good intentions can get involved with these organizations and vice versa. I don't know if the distinction between spirituality and the political is one that I am comfortable with, especially if you say people with the political agenda are the ones that are the bad guys and the people with the spiritual agenda are the good guys. I would almost want to reverse that because for a long time, the spiritual leaders have been political leaders, and the justification for any kind of social order that we have has always been ultimately a spiritual one, that you're in law, you know, that the leaders or the society we're in is aligned with some sort of cosmic principle or God's will or, you know, the harmony of the spheres or what have you. And people who are overtly political are kind of more honestly saying, hey, this is a human construct that I'm trying to impose. This is, you know, I'm actually not justifying my actions based on God, but I'm just trying to make a political order that I think is just. And so.
Sure. Well, from my point of view, I mean, I think that I've kind of ignored, at least downplayed, the political aspect and tended to see that the spiritual perspective incorporated the political. Therefore, anything that appeared to be political was really spiritual underneath, like there was a larger spiritual dimension to that, right?
Right.
Whereas now I seem to be seeing it from the other side, which is that anything that appears to be spiritual is actually political.
And I think both those positions are basically correct, but I would replace the word spiritual with a fancy philosophical term and say ontological, because what you're saying is the spiritual leaders are saying, I know what really is. I know how things are. And right. I know the foundation of life. And therefore, I know how we should, as a people, get in step with what really is. And so I think that any political effort has to posit some way that things really are. Even like postmodern relativists kind of end up positing this kind of ground that they're walking on, the way things really are. And So you can't escape this desire to explain the world and how it really is and make a kind of metaphysical claims from the desire to change or shape the way you live. These things are always intertwined.
I think that's true.
Do you know about Dr. Cameron, Dr. Donald Cameron, who was part of the MK Ultra mind control program in Canada?
Oh yeah, I think we'll see the guy who gave people LSD and wiped out their memories.
Yeah, and like wanted to destroy their personalities altogether and replace them with better personalities.
Right.
What's interesting about him was that he was, that his ideology was basically liberal. He was really concerned about fascism, and he wanted to wipe out the authoritarian personalities that he was encountering to give people these more liberal, progressive personalities. So it's kind of weird. Because, of course, he's this extremely authoritarian act of, like, just wiping the person out.
Right. Well, that's kind of a classic case of disowning a part of the psyche and how you become the very thing that you're trying to eradicate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, what is he disowning?
He's disowning the totalitarian fascist side of his own personality.
Right. He's disowned.
And so then he's trying to get rid of it in everyone else in order to get rid of it in himself, but then he's becoming the very thing that he's trying to get rid of.
He's disowning what maybe we would just call the spiritual side, because he's disowning the side where you have to posit a ground before you can do any walking.
Oh, well, that's a different point.
Well,
that's a valid point too, but I was just pointing out how he was, by trying to rid people of that authoritarian side, he was becoming the ultimate authoritarian.
Right. Right. And I think that's what happens when you don't recognize how you are always having to posit the ground.
Unless you're willing to actually do the work to find it. If work is the work, in the literal sense, it's work, as far as getting to the bedrock.
Right.
I think this is a fundamental point. I think it's worth lingering on that because it's very much, somebody recently asked me like why I was doing this whole project, and that was the best answer I could give, as I'm trying to find the ground. And so I've had all of these beliefs, these spiritual, shamanic, occult, etc. Beliefs that I've considered to be the ground, like I've mistaken for ontological facts. I've never used that word before, but now that we've thrown it out there. And so I'm trying to pass away all of those assumptions and those misattributing ontological status to artifacts of belief,
mm-hmm.
to find the ground. I mean, and what is the alternative to finding the ground? It's what you're talking about with this guy. It's creating a fake ground of some kind.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think that there's I get confused here at this moment, because the alternative to finding the ground is to recognize that you already are walking on one, that you don't have the option to not have a ground, that you, whenever you strike off to look for the ground, you already have to posit a place where you're standing. You already have to kind of know what reality is in order to
find
it.
That's true. Well, that's somewhat true. But if you don't mind my implying this metaphor of finding gold that has been useful to me, the ground isn't the bedrock, right? Yeah, there is ground in the sense that we're always standing somewhere, and in order to start digging, in order to start trying to get the lay of the land, we have to, you know, have something to start with.
Mm-hmm.
But the bedrock is hidden. So you might mistake rocks and boulders and you know, hard dirt, whatever, for for bedrock, but it's not. Until you actually start digging, you've no idea really what the lay of the land is. You're just seeing the deposit that's been left by millennia of, you know, geological movements and river flow and all the rest of it. But in order to find the gold, you have to find the bedrock. And in order to find the bedrock, you have to actually recognize that the ground you're standing on isn't it.
Okay, yeah. Right. That's true. I agree with that fundamentally. To put it in different terms, like metaphysical terms, like in order to find the ground, you have to first recognize that you don't have it. You know, and then, you know, like you're not that. There's this moment like where you realize, oh, the world that I think I know is just the world of all of my own thoughts. And it seems to be the real world is outside of me and beyond. There's a barrier between me and it, and I have to get past that barrier, whether it's the surface of the ground or the matrix, you know, of preconditioned programming, or, you know,
like the deposits of the past.
Right. But in order, you still have to kind of posit that you yourself, that your judgments are sound, so that you
don't despair completely.
Well, just so that you can go on this quest to get past the surface, that your judgment that this is a surface and there's something beyond that is right. You know, it's just this sort of paradoxical flip. You can just always do this flip. On the one hand, you have to recognize you don't have reality in order to strike off to try to find it. On the other hand, you also have to think that you do.
Have the capacity to discern over time and to learn discernment even through. I mean, I would say it's not to oversimplify, but to simplify at least, that reducing. Well, this fellow researcher, Ty Brown, put it very well. That one thing he'd learned through all of his research, Streams End was also what he went by, and he did a lot of looking into Whitley Strieber and SRI and all of that a few years ago. And I asked him for any tips he could give on getting lost in Chapel Perilous, as he put it. And he said that he could reduce it to one phrase, and that was observe more, interpret less.
Mm-hmm.
So then, if you extend that, say that the degree to which we turn to our senses, our physical senses, to check what's going on, rather than relying on our thoughts and feelings, learning that, like, I mean, this is in terms of looking for gold. The more expectations, the more ideas, the more fantasies, the more hopes that you bring to the ground, the harder it's going to be for you to actually read the ground, because you're just constantly going to be projecting those ideas. You're going to be telling the ground what you want, and not like a religious person who only talks to God and doesn't listen, to use a cliche. You're having a dialogue with yourself, really.
Yeah. Well, I, you know, in my day-to-day life, I probably don't pay enough attention to, like, my body and what it's telling me. And, you know, like, my habits aren't great. And I could do with a little bit of practical, you know, reason or practical thought rather than some grand, you know, theoretical abstract reasoning that I don't need. I'm in no need of more of that. So I kind of have this, like, I want to confess. Yeah, you're right. Especially when it comes to me. You're right. But at the same time, you know, I have this strong tendency to say, but wait, whenever you're dealing with an empirical fact, you can't get away from the reality that you're imposing some sort of understanding onto what you're seeing from the get-go, just in order to to have an experience, you have to make it every experience is kind of theory laden. And let me give you an example. There was like an empiricist philosopher who said, you know, there is something that we could call precepts, just our perceptions directly. And these precepts, you know, aren't shaped by our concepts. They're just raw experiences. For instance, you might just have the precept of redness or the precept of a mass or a shape. And I was like, well, wait a minute. As soon as you start to say what the precept is, you have to go to these universal concepts, like what it is to be red. And just by describing what you're trying to posit, you contradict yourself. So what I've been trying to struggle after is a way of thinking out this contradiction, not so much trying to like find direct lived experience or just, you know, getting rid of theory and not saying, okay, well, I'm going to just focus on the very best abstraction and really just focus on changing my concepts, but like going, well, what is this relationship? Why is it that everything ends up in a contradiction or a paradox? And what can I say about the world having observed that fact?
Well, I guess because you're a writer like myself, we can't really separate, and maybe nobody can, but I think it's particularly acute for a writer who is working with internal imagery and concepts and thoughts, and that is kind of those are our tools, and that's also the ground that we're looking for is sort of inseparably tangled up with thoughts and concepts and all the rest of it. So that, I think that does complicate things, I agree. But I still think you can bring it back to this metaphor that the physical reality remains for all of our concepts and all of the filters and all of the images and concepts and precepts and all the rest of it that come between us and the physical reality. It still remains, and there are still basic sort of tenets that you can refer to. There are still basic checks that are the equivalent of the guy out there in the wilderness who's looking for gold, and if he's honest with himself, at least about what he's doing and what the results are, like, then over time he's going to notice the ways in which his theories and his ideas are actually hindering him. Because there is the basic, is he finding gold or is he not? Right.
Right.
We have that. I mean, as writers and as whatever else you consider yourself to be, I can't even think of a term offhand, explorers, psychological explorers, we are looking for some sort of goal. We're looking for something that will actually transform our lives in some way, I think.
Yeah. Well, and so, but the one question, I guess, is why are we looking? Why isn't it enough for us to, if there are these lived experiences, this kind of natural check, if there are these natural checks on our ideas, and the world is really out there to hold us in place, and we could just listen to our bodies to figure out what we need. Why do we need to look? Why isn't it just happening? And
maybe it is.
Well, yeah, I think we do feel this need to look. And there was this section in what you wrote that was a quote from Whitley Strieber about how when he was very young, he had these experiences that shattered the mirror of expectation, he says, and that his understanding of reality had been upended, that he just kind of had lost hold of that feeling that he was secure in what was there, because the mirror of his perception, basically, he saw a crack in it. He saw or more than that, maybe it just got blown completely away and he had this break. But but he also calls that a door of perception, as if you could pass through perception to the other side of it. So that's what we're trying to do, I guess, is that's what there seems to be some sort of barrier, or we start to realize that we're looking at a reflection, or that that there's a crack in the surface of our experience, and that we want to go through that.
Well, I think that's interesting thought there, because I think, you know, what Willie's describing is his mirror got shattered, and so he saw there was something on the other side, and that was the other, that was the alien, and that took him through into this other place. Mm-hmm. But the alternative is that, as saying that we all have these mirrors of expectation, as in our ideas that are conditioned into us, which we then project onto the world. But those mirrors are all cracked to some extent, because it can never be, our expectations can never actually completely overlay the reality in front of us. So we're all of us looking at a crack, or we're looking at a mirror that is cracked. And I think that the alternative, perhaps not the only, but the obvious alternative to what Whitley did was to shatter the mirror, is to try and cover the crack, to try and repair the crack.
Mm-hmm.
And my feeling, based on this current exploration with Strieber, is that the hardest thing and the truest way, and maybe the only way that really works, is to do neither, is to not try and cover up the crack or fix the crack, but also not to try and shatter the mirror, or for the mirror not to be shattered.
Mm.
Because that's also both provide relief. Like what Strieber is describing, I think, is this kind of dissociation, like his experiences became so overwhelming that he was fragmented, his mirror was shattered, and he had access to this other world, and so he perceives it as being rescued by the visitors from this intolerable conditions. Not only that, but that those intolerable conditions allowed him to make this breakthrough into this higher level of experience.
Mm-hmm.
But I would question that. I mean, I would question that kind of access to a higher reality, if it's dependent on the fragmentation or the shattering of the ego in that way, then it's really dissociative. It's fragmentation of the psyche.
I agree with two things that you said. One is that I worry about the necessity for like a dissociation or a psychotic break being like the what's necessary for the realization of reality, or like even in psychoanalysis, there's this talk of, you know, at the end of psychoanalysis, what you have is subjective destitution. Where you've kind of lost your sense of self or purpose, or, you know, you've been emptied out. You've gone through and said everything. You've gotten to a point where you can just free associate without even trying to understand it, or trying to present a certain image of yourself to the psychiatrist or psychoanalyst. And, you know, you're just speaking without speaking to anyone, and you know, you've kind of lost the sense of who you are, this subjective destitution, which you know, is supposedly the end of psychoanalysis, at least from, you know, Lacan's one psychoanalyst's theory. So I don't understand how that could be a good thing, and why that isn't going to just lead to more problems. But I have this sort of hope that if I understood it properly, or, you know, that it might, after all. But the other thing that I agree with is this idea that, you know, Strieber is trying to fix the crack or cover up the crack, and like that maybe UFO people and aliens and all of that is a way of doing that. That, because, well, I interviewed Bud Hopkins a while ago, before he died. And
I didn't know that. Is that on your website?
Yeah, it's on Diet Soap. It's old. I'm not sure if it's still up. If it isn't, I need to upload it again. But I talked to him. He was an abstract expressionist, and a painter and also a UFO researcher. So the first interview I did with him was about abstract expressionism, and then the second was about UFOs, or it was like one conversation broken in half. And my favorite Bud Hopkins abductee story was about this family who had gone to Coney Island, and they had been taking, you know, photographs of themselves and, you know, like, you know, commemorating their trip. And when they got back and had the photographs printed, they found that in many of the photographs, the subjects of the photographs were missing. The father and the child were not there. They had these sort of reddish photos of empty spaces, with, like, you know, just a slide, but nobody in front of it and nobody on it. And so they went to Bud Hopkins and showed him these and said, "Have you seen anything like this before?" And he's like, "Well, you mean the coloration?" They said, No. We're supposed to be in these pictures. I remember taking them, and I was taking them of my, you know, husband and son, and now they're gone. They're not in the shot." And then he put them through hypnosis, and an explanation came forward, which is that they had been abducted right before the picture was taken. And that you know, they had gone up into the mothership and the, you know, in the beam of light and all that. And then the photo had been taken, and the person who'd taken the photo had just been frozen there for a while until the whole scenario concluded, and then they had their memory erased, right? But I just found that whole story as to why it happened much less interesting than the pictures. You know, here that you've got, you know, like what they're trying to cover up is the disappearance of themselves, the fact that they can't get a hold of themselves, and so they create this whole elaborate story about somebody else and aliens and things that are doing something to them to make it difficult. But the real lived experience is just that whenever you try to get a hold of yourself, you're not there. Right. And so that's my favorite Bud Hopkins abductee scenario, because first of all, I like the little photo. I like the photos themselves, and I wish I could remember the name of the couple that went to him. But
so you saw the photo?
Yeah, well, they're online. Mm-hmm. But I can't. I'll try to send it to you later. I can't remember their name. But
I feel slightly dissociated just hearing that story.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk about trauma for a minute, because, you know, we had this conversation about Freud. I was kind of irritably defending Freud online to you, or I sent you a message about it. And yeah. Freud had this theory about childhood abuse, and at first he thought that the symptoms he was seeing in his patients were the result of actual physical abuse. And then later, he decided that what he was dealing with were the fantasies of the kids and not necessarily real lived experiences.
Right, but then apparently he also stressed that that didn't make it less real. By fantasy, he didn't mean that there wasn't some real...
Right, but it was... one way of understanding this is like to think about the trauma of witnessing the primal scene, which is like when you discover your parents doing it, and why that's traumatic. Like, so let's say you're 3 years old and you encounter your parents screwing in their bed, and you're like, "What are they doing? It's very active," you know. You probably don't have you're not traumatized by that experience immediately. It's only when your own sexuality starts to be a problem for you that memory returns as a significant trauma, and it starts to be meaningful for you. At least that's the theory. It's like, it's not, the trauma isn't only in the physical act that you've witnessed or the perception, but that it's the interpretation of it that lends it a traumatic quality. So like another way, like if you receive a beating, you know, that's not necessarily going to be traumatic. It may be harmful to you, you know, but it won't be the kind of psychological trauma necessarily that we're talking about. Like you could be a boxer and just be beaten to a bloody pulp and not,
sure.
Right? It's when when the meaning of your life and your security through that meaning is undermined, that it becomes a trauma.
So I think there's a question of meaning there is what I would zero in on, because like if a child sees a primal scene, one of the things that would be disturbing to it, not to say traumatic, is that it doesn't know what it means. And so then it has to leave that, or at least has the option of leaving that as some unknown, but it might be threatening in some way, and it might be threatening to the child for specific reasons that it, although it wouldn't understand, it would definitely experience it as a threat, just in terms of the father having access to the mother in the way that it wants, and it being shut out of some experience that it senses is somehow primal.
Mm-hmm.
So, what I mean, put that on one side for a minute and bring it back to the beating. From what I've picked up, reading about this, but also kind of making my own deductions, my own experiences, what's traumatic to a child if it's beaten by its caregiver or abused by its caregiver isn't so much the experience itself, but the way that it has to give meaning to the experience.
Right.
So then if a child is mistreated by a caregiver, it depends on that caregiver for its survival. And so the idea that the caregiver is good and benevolent and looking after it is essential. Like the possibility that that wouldn't be the case would be life-threatening. Mm. So the child has, to simplify, it has two options. It can interpret, if it's being mistreated by a caregiver, it can interpret that to mean that the caregiver is somehow bad, and therefore experience the existential terror of actually being in the hands of some, evil or abusive caregiver who's not giving care, or it can turn that around and identify itself as bad, as wrong, and therefore the caregiver is still being benevolent and good, but is giving the child exactly what it needs because the child is bad, right? The child is being punished.
Right.
So, and that is, so if a child is abused and is experiencing that crisis, if you will, that existential crisis, very primal existential crisis, but nonetheless, I think that's probably the right term for it. The way that it survives it psychologically often, and maybe mostly, is by turning against itself. So then it becomes an internal abuser. It actually identifies with the abusive caregiver or parent, sees that as good, and sees itself as bad. And so then there's a split whereby it continues to traumatize itself in order to maintain that meaning that it's clinging to, that the caregiver is good.
Right. Yeah, okay. And so to make this really abstract, let's take the parents and caregivers out of the story and just talk about like any person's relationship with the world, because in a way we rely on the world for the world we're in for our survival. We have to have the world be a place that makes sense, and that, you know, we hope that the world is basically, I think the secret hope is that we think the world might be for us, that its role, the whole world, the world of experience, is there to maintain and support us in our existence, right?
Like the mother's body.
Right. And so when we discover that actually the world, that world that's supposed to be there to maintain us is really inaccessible to us, and that all we've got is this sort of shadow of it, of our own perceptions, there's a tendency to turn against ourselves and to want to return to the world outside, to maintain this idea that the world outside of us is really good, and the only problem is that we're not perceiving it correctly. We're not in line with it. And right. And I guess what I want to say is, okay, that it really there's a trauma, but the trauma is what constitutes our relationship with the world. It's like we don't even know of the caregiver as something separate from ourselves until we've got the trauma, until it doesn't support us properly.
Yeah.
And so then so that lack of support, that trauma is sort of built into us being who we are, that we shouldn't turn against ourselves and think, oh, the problem's in us. We should like recognize, the problem is just fundamental. This problem is really what defines existence. This impossibility of being fully integrated is like the starting point. It's step one. You're not going to be fully supported. There's going to be a trauma. Now, you know, obviously there are greater or lesser degrees of trauma, and it can, you know, if you're completely disconnected from any kind of feeling of support, you're not going to be able to survive. But you're not going to be able to keep reproducing that same relationship either. So it's like, I on the one hand, I kind of want to say, yeah, we should protect that impossibility exactly where it is without letting it overwhelm us. On the other hand, like if we want to change, maybe we have to let the impossibility, that contradiction, that trauma, wipe us out.
So what is the impossibility then?
The impossibility is this, it's impossible for the world to be just in itself
for
itself, or for us. I mean, well, once there's an us, then that means that there's a split. So you have to start with the impossibility of the world itself. Like the world itself just can't be in and out, in itself and for itself, in an undifferentiated way that isn't traumatic. Like the world itself has to have trauma in it, has to have this contradiction in it, or else it's the same as nothing.
Thank you.
is basically what I'm saying. Maybe that's too, you know.
Well, I think there's two things you're talking about, though. I mean, one is what you just said about the trauma and how there's no way to avoid trauma or remove trauma, which seems like we've talked about previously, mm-hmm. last time. But the other thing is I'm curious about is this idea that we want the world to be just for us, to have a direct one-to-one symbiotic relationship with the world, as we experienced with the mother,
right?
Or at least,
yeah.
If we did, if we didn't, we're going to want it even more severely,
right?
And so it seems to me that this does. I think this is a really crucial fiction. The idea that the world is just for us, and that we can have a direct one-to-one relationship with it, and maybe it's so crucial or so powerful a fiction because there is this kernel of truth in it. I was just reading Strieber yesterday. I actually posted my blog because it was such an interesting interview. Where he, one of the things he said in the midst of many other things is that this is why he says, I felt, or maybe always felt, that God was staring me in the face the whole time. Yeah, I think it was in the present. This is why I feel that God is always staring me in the face the whole time. And he said, I think that this is true. God is literally staring us in the face all of the time. Now, I won't go into his reason for this. He came up with quite a typically complex and nuanced and fantastic reason for why he would think this. Mm-hmm. But I think that the alien experience, just as the religious experience, if you have a very strong religious belief, as a Catholic say, you will feel, and it's often a negative way, like if you're sinning, you're afraid that God is watching, right? Mm-hmm. But either way, you may often feel this way, that God is directly involved in your life in some way, that he's invested in it. And this, it seems that the alien, the whole alien UFO mythology, has kind of superimposed itself on top of that religious belief system. And to that degree that people who are abducted by aliens or even who read about it and begin to have intimations of it, there's that feeling that the world is conscious, that the world is consciously engaged with us, that it is invested in us, that it's actually inviting us into this one-on-one direct relationship with it.
Yeah.
Because, like, otherwise we're just this planet floating in space, and space is just empty and there's nothing out there, and that's a terrifying isolation feeling. The alternative being that actually it's, you know,
yeah, yeah,
this fantastic cosmos.
Not only is it, you know, a terrible feeling, it's one that I find impossible to maintain. Like, you know, the problem of how to be an atheist is much more difficult than most people who say they're atheists understand, because what you have to constantly check is this idea that there's somebody watching you, judging what you're doing, which I think we almost all experience. That, you know, in order for us to kind of know what's right and wrong, or, you know, to operate, we sort of have to imagine that there's some judge that's sort mm-hmm. of there to, that's, you know, watching us and understanding what's happening to us. And because if we try to do it just by ourselves, there's like this strange feedback loop. It just seems almost impossible to imagine that isn't happening. If you think, okay, I know there's no God and I'm just alone, I know I'm right because as soon as you say because, you have to posit some other judge that's verifying you. Something outside of yourself that, you know, to be truly alone means you'd have to be the source of all value. You'd have no way of, like, figuring out what was going on, because there'd be nothing to compare yourself to. So what we want mm-hmm. is somebody out there who's doing the judging for us, and then we can try to get ourselves in line with it. I feel like I'm going way off here because I wanted to say something about UFOs and Jesus by the Pepsi machine, because I had this thought about why aliens are always so elusive, why UFOs are always, you know, never really going to land on the White House lawn. And because I remember dealing with a fundamentalist Christian at my work years ago, and he was telling me that Jesus is always, could always come back, and he's always just almost right there. And I said, so if he wanted to, because we were by the Pepsi machine, he could just appear here by the Pepsi machine. He said, yes. And I said, well, why isn't he then? He says, well, you know, because he doesn't want to. But but the thing is, if he were to appear right there next to the Pepsi machine, then he would be way too small to be Jesus anymore, you know, to be the kind of all-seeing eye that we need. He'd just be another schmuck. Yeah. And the same with UFOs. If they were to land on the White House lawn and be present and start to be something we could really know about, then they would lose this quality of being in the background supporting us. That's what the UFO story is about. That's what the Jesus story is about. It's not about giving us this, you know, one-on-one, person-to-person, entity-to-entity kind of relationship. It's this, you know, relationship with the big everything behind
it. Something beyond ourselves, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we're like positing something that could possibly exist above and beyond our own kind of confining identity, that prison that we feel trapped in.
Right.
But then if it were actually to come into this prison of our own limited minds and belief systems, to free us, it would become imprisoned also.
Yeah, it would be as limited as we are. Yeah. Which is, by the way, the actual real Christian story.
Right.
that you know, Jesus came to earth and was a man as much as he was God. And, you know, and then you have to ask, you know, why was he crucified? You know, and it was because, I think it was because, I don't know, it seems to me like there's this something about the fact that trauma is intrinsic, is there in the Christian story. You know, once God comes into reality, he pretty much has to die. And so,
isn't it the integration, like the spirit being integrated into matter, means that matter has to get its claws into spirit?
Yeah, but then how do we know it as matter as opposed to spirit? If we only have one or the other, then we are kind of adrift. You know, if we only have spirit, then there doesn't seem to be any ground. And if there's only matter, then there doesn't seem to be any meaning.
So can we bring this back down to earth then? Sure. Is this like mother and father stuff again?
I think so, yeah. I think that would be another way to think about it. Sure.
I was talking to somebody yesterday about if you could go back into your past, imagine if you could follow your sense of identity all the way back, or your sense of being a conscious existence. At a certain point, you would get split in two, because you would be part of you would be in the mother's ovum, and the other part would be in the father's scrotum.
Right. Right. Well, I would, at that point, would you even have what would we be talking about? I mean,
exactly. I mean, I had to adapt it from identity to consciousness. I mean, if we exist as consciousness prior to form, well, that's the big if, of course, right there. That is maybe the question mark.
The reverse of that is just as weird, which was there any form before there was consciousness?
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I think that's just as impossible.
I don't know how anyone manages to be an atheist, Doug. You know, I mean, is that what you mean partly by how hard it is?
Yeah. It seems really hard to be an atheist. It's, you know, but it does seem like it's worth the trying to for.
I was obviously thinking of my brother, and if his case I need to go by, but also my own feeling, my own experiences, the only way to be an atheist is actually to be a nihilist.
Yeah.
You have to actively negate, and even aggressively negate, which is an affirmation, as we know. Whatever we negate, we affirm.
Well, there's others who would say, well, there's one guy I know who would say, there's Zizek, would say the only way, the only an atheist can be a true Christian today. That and you know, the Christians were called atheists originally because they didn't believe in, not only because they didn't believe in the gods, the other gods, the Roman gods, the pagan gods, but they also didn't seem to really have a firm belief in their own god, because anytime you tried to say anything about their god, they would say, nope, that's not it. That's too small. That can't be it. It's not flying saucers coming down. No, it's not a wheel of fire. Mm-hmm. No, it's not some sort of bull with, you know, magic lassos or anything. It's it's none of those things. It's almost only a no. That's the idea of a Christian god.
Huh.
So,
because you can't represent it in any way. Can't be represented.
Right. Yeah. Because once it's represented, then that's putting a limit on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that is common sense. That's good logic,
yeah.
Essentially. But then you shouldn't be able to give it a name either.
Right.
Because that's a representation, too.
Right. And certainly it shouldn't be able to turn itself into a man and come walk around. That should be completely impossible.
But isn't it all completely impossible?
Yes.
I mean, that's what I mean. Like, yeah. For me, all I have to do, well, I say all, it is enough to just put my attention on this moment as much as I can, to realize the absolute impossibility of existence in a very visceral sense.
Yeah.
You know what I mean by that?
Yeah, I do.
I mean, the odds are so against us being here now that they're non-existent.
It's not even just a matter of odds. It's just like it seems constructed to be an impossibility. In reality, it seems like they're really, like, if you're just trying to be as efficient as possible about things, that there shouldn't be anything. That would be the most logical thing in the world. Why could there be anything? And I guess the reason why I say that is because it seems like, well, just for instance, in order for there to be something, there has to be a nothing for it to be in. Right. So, but so why should something come out of nothing?
Yeah. Well, how?
Right. Yeah. So, but see,
the answer is it wouldn't need to, and it couldn't. So then, therefore, there's nothing.
Right.
I mean, that's the logical answer.
I mean, but this goes back to the photographs where you know, have you seen anything like this before? They say the Buddha Hopkins, and there's a picture of, basically, a picture of nothing. Oh. It's like, so, you know, I don't want to get so far off into, you know, abstractions that we lose sight of the kind of the story that's being told here about, you know, the problem. Because the one really interesting way the story is being told is as the story of flying saucers, and the story of, or you can tell it as a religious story, but it's like these things are really helpful and to understand it, and also the UFO story is useful because it's kind of scary too, and you know, there's two ways it's scary. One, what if they're real? What if they really are out there? And then the other scary thing is, what if they're just as stupid, the idea is just as stupid as everyone says, and you're acting like an idiot even talking about them. So, like, you know.
Oh, you have that fear?
Yeah, somewhat. I don't want to be, you know, a loon. I don't.
A sucker.
Huh?
A sucker.
Yeah.
No. A loon is relatively okay compared to being a sucker, isn't it?
I guess. Yeah,
and I guess that's part of what I'm looking into now. Is I do feel to some extent that I was suckered, not by the grand conspiracy or the meme builders or the Illumineers or anything like that, or by Whitley Strieber, but my stammer there. What I've termed my Mulder complex, my want to believe. I want to believe in something. And this is, I think, this is the crux, pun intended, of these stories that we weave in the infinite nothingness, this something that we bring into the void. I think we're doing it. I mean, that's what God did, or whatever did, mm-hmm. for there to be something. We're all like these mini generators of meaning and of narratives to bring something into the nothing. And this is I think we do it on a macro level, and we do it on a micro level. So I have found like the macro narrative, or the collective narrative that I've hooked into, to kind of glam up and boost up, you know, turbo boost my own personal narrative, which is like Strieber's, like many others. Oh yes, I was abducted by aliens, or I was genetically modified by, you know, imaginal beings, or etc. You know, that whole "I am the one, I'm the center of the universe, and the universe is interacting directly with me" narrative that we all need one way or another. I found, you know, the handy collective narrative that allowed me to believe that, but while at the same time not stretching my credibility too much. I couldn't be a Christian, I couldn't be a Muslim, but I could be an alien participant.
Well, yeah, but it's interesting though, because I don't know if like the Christian or traditional religious approach to this doesn't put the individual at the center. It says, you know, your life has meaning because of this entire structure outside of you that you can find a place within, but not that this entire structure, not directly that this entire structure is about just you.
No, you can't. There's only one Jesus, that's true, and there's only one Muhammad, but you still have that, like Christians believe they have a personal relationship with Jesus. Right.
Right.
And the lost sheep is worth more than the 99 found, and God looks after every sparrow and every hair on your head. And so, because it's a sort of both and thing, or have your cake and eat it, because God is omniscient and omnipresent. And I think that there's some truth in this, like a holographic model of existence or consciousness. God can be everywhere at once. Like, how does Santa go to every home in the world in, in a few hours?
He doesn't. But even to say that is wrong, because, you know. But okay, I've recently stumbled upon a Facebook conversation where someone said, was quoting Daniel Dennett. You know who he is?
No.
I barely do. He's some sort of one of the new atheists, and I think he's a mathematician. I don't remember exactly, but he's one of these guys that are hyper rationalist, and he was saying that the purpose and meaning of life is to find something more important than yourself and then put yourself into service of it.
Sure. Well, that's not exactly new, is it?
No.
But that's an atheist, I guess, is what it's,
yeah.
That's what makes
but,
it new.
Yeah, as an atheist, he was saying that. And so that means that's sort of the existentialist thing. It's like you have to choose what it is that's most important and then, you know, commit to it. But there's an impossibility there. The first comment was from somebody who was quite bright, I thought, who pointed out that as soon as you try to become the instrument of this thing that's more important than yourself, you become the way the thing is actually coming into the world. Therefore, you know, the thing that's most...
You're more important than the thing. At that point.
Exactly.
At least in a worldly sense.
Right.
Yeah.
You become more important than the abstraction.
Well, plus you're presuming you're giving yourself a certain amount of status in that you can choose what it is.
Right.
So you're determining what is the most important thing in the universe.
Which means that by definition you have to be more important than it anyway, because you're the thing that distinguishes. So so not to...
And the Christian thing, because I had this experience when I toyed with the idea of joining a Benedictine monastery. Mm-hmm. My sort of preliminary interview included the question like, have you chosen Christ? And I thought about it for a few seconds, and I said, it's not really a choice. And his eyes lit up, and he said, oui, c'est lui qui choisit, he that chooses. So that's the Christian thing, is that you don't choose Christ. Apparently, Christ chooses you.
Right.
And that would be, I think, I mean, if there is something that's worth giving your life to, I would think that there was only one thing. I can't imagine there being a sort of smorgasbord of, shall I give my life to that? Shall I give my life to this?
Right. Right, because as soon as you think that, then there's nothing. There can't be anything that's most important. If it's just a matter of you choosing, then, you know.
Right, exactly. It has to be the underlying source of everything.
Yeah, like, I mean, to bring this to a political perspective, you know, we think we live in a world of free choice where we're just constantly, you know, deciding based on our own whims what's most important to us. But in reality, there's always this underlying structure that is directing what our choices are, because what's going to be most important to us is ultimately what helps us make money or is the best value. You know, there's always this kind of thing that really does stand above everything else that you don't get to choose.
Mm-hmm.
But then we kind of pretend as though, you know, oh, that doesn't exist. And we're free to choose anything we want.
Well, do you think it's kind of layers and layers there? Because I was thinking the term implicate order, which is David Bohm's phrase,
mm-hmm.
For the underlying order or design of creation, but spiritual teachers call it the unmanifest. So, but if you bring it from starting with what you're talking about, the political thing, that's similar to what you're describing, like there's an implicate order in the socio-political structures, capitalism and etc. That is really it's rigging the game, and so you can go in the supermarket, you feel like you've got this enormous amount of choice between detergents, like overwhelming really, but the fact is you're still just choosing a detergent, and that's kind of like a way to foster this illusion of choice, because we've got these incredibly petty choices within the system,
right,
but there's no choice not to buy. We have to get detergent if we want to wash our dishes.
Right, right.
So that's one level. But then what about beneath that level, the implicate order of our own patterns, which say out those formative experiences as infants and even in the womb, that kind of lay down the blueprint of our character. The character is destiny and all that. So then in a similar way, you could say that we're also... We've generated this surface illusion of making choices, when in fact we're just constantly being driven by the same program.
Yeah.
Psychologically speaking, and then you could even take it a deeper level to Bohm's idea that the whole universe is running on some sort of program.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the question of free will versus determinism is kind of what comes up at this point. But it seems, to be impossible to really be a determinist. I mean, just as it's impossible to be an atheist, to believe that there's nobody out there judging us, which means that at that point there's really no separation from reality and our experience in a certain way. But so we can't quite believe that, and we can't at the same time just believe that we are, you know, moved by forces. That seems like part of our experience is always that we're making choices. You know, I can choose to pick up a pen or not. I have this moments of choice that just seem like they're, I couldn't imagine. If I were to imagine that I didn't, what would happen? Would I do anything at all? Would I be making the choice not to move at that point?
Have you read Lloyd DeMaus at all?
No.
So I've just been looking into him, and I just posted some segments at my blog, and one of the things, it's quite radical, and it's like he posits the idea that the treatment of infants is the primary factor in shaping history. Can you put it broadly like that? It actually seems kind of common sense. To me, at least.
Say it again.
Well, he's written a book called The Emotional Life of Nations, and to give an example he gives, when people talk about nations going to war, people can write that, there's hundreds of books about war, and none of them mention anger. like wars are never seen as being motivated by emotions. They're always seen as being moved by political considerations and social factors. But he turns it on his head and says that society and therefore history.
Hold on a second. No, I'm not quite done yet. I'll be done in a little bit.
Who are you talking to?
I'm talking to Jason.
Okay.
All right. That's my son.
Yeah. That's a touch of reality there. So history and society is shaped by psychological patterns, by emotions, by feelings, by thoughts, by individuals, and that those individuals and their patterns are shaped by those formative experiences. Therefore, he turns on his head and says that in order to understand history, you have to understand the treatment of children throughout history and how we've been formed by that treatment. And so, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but it came up because of the question of free will. What's particularly radical to me in what he's describing is that the only thing that can change over time, in his opinion, is incremental change in the way that mothers, specifically before fathers, relate to their children.
Mm.
And he's not arguing some sort of social program in order to improve the treatment of children. I mean, he does encourage that mothers are supported. But essentially what he's saying, it's a question of individual choices. And that the more incidents in which a mother chooses to forgo or to forbear from reacting to her own patterns, having been abused as a child, having all of that, those memories and those experiences stirred up by having her own child, who she identifies with, all of that tension in the psyche, which it's very likely to come out in hostility towards the children. Like in this very kind of simple terms, like people who have children because they hope it's going to complete them in some way. And then when they see that the child, that's not going to happen, the child exists in its own right, they resent that. And so that's all part of like a parent using a child to somehow fill a void within themselves caused by their own trauma, and then when that doesn't happen, to take that out on the child, so they're passing on the trauma. So what he's positing is that the only thing that can change this endless historical vicious circle is choosing not to react, is choosing to forbear. So the more instances in which a mother actually swallows her own pain rather than taking it out on the child, the more that will allow for this wound to become healed. In other words, so I say it was radical to me, what he's saying is the primary and even only factor determining our evolution of the species is choice.
I agree with that part of I like the fact that one of the most important things is to not react, to suppress your natural kind of reaction, which is probably going to be based on your own trauma. I really like that. It reminds me of something Miriam is doing these days, which is she's taking Alexander technique lessons, which is, you know, you learn to use your body as an instrument rather than fall into unhealthy patterns. You know, people have a tendency to overwork their muscles, to do more than is necessary in order to make a gesture, or to tense up to do something that, like, if you're trying to walk fast, you might tense up your shoulders, that kind of thing. You just like to try to suppress that tensing up of your shoulders and just use the parts of your body that you need to get what you're trying to accomplish done, or to, you know, suppress your urge to all sorts of ways that you might kind of tense up and do things that are counterproductive. The first thing you have to do to learn to do that is to basically say, okay, I'm going to suppress that. I'm going to suppress this. I'm not going to do this. It's not a matter of doing something right first. It's a matter of stopping yourself.
Yeah. Although I think suppress is, I think if it involves any kind of force, I think that can be counterproductive. So I don't want to seem to be splitting hairs, but I think there's probably a better word. I think it's more like containment. Because you don't want to suppress the feeling, do you? Because then it's just going to get pushed down and it's going to stay there. You want to actually allow the feeling of anguish and rage or whatever it is to come all the way into awareness, but to contain it physically so that you're not reacting to it.
Well, I mean, if you're not reacting, can you really have a feeling that isn't being on some level expressed? You know, can it really be?
Probably not. Yeah. And children are very sensitive, so they would even pick up, you know, on a frown or a grunt. But at least I think it is that middle way, isn't it? Because lots of parents suppress their feelings and try to be perfect parents, and that's the worst thing.
What they do is they suppress their awareness of it, yeah. But they don't suppress the acting out of it. You know, it's like you actually don't. It's like how we believe things. Like I have a problem sometimes with my wife's church because no one who goes to that church really believes that the doctrine of the church. But they don't have to because the church is doing their believing for them. They go ahead and act as though they believe, and without, so they can suppress their belief. They don't have to believe, but the church does it for them. Or
is this your own personal theory? Or
no, it's not. But it's something I've noticed. It's like a belief. It's something I came upon again back to Zizek. But then I've seen it in action. I really have like witnessed this happening. That people constantly. The authority will act itself out that way all the time. It will always be like saying, "I don't believe that we should lower everyone's wages," but you know, the institution I'm in makes me have to do this anyway. So even though I don't, you know, actually believe in it, I'm going to act it out.
Well, that's also what Damaris writes about. He calls it social altars. I just posted about this, the way that we create and or join groups that will thereby act out our own suppressed feelings in a way we won't have to feel guilty about them afterwards.
Right.
So that's how nations go to war, basically.
Right. So we don't even know we're angry. We don't have to feel angry. Right. In fact, the more, if you're... To be good at warfare, you have to suppress that anger. And because if you just acted it out, you'd do irrational things. You'd have to, so the institution right. is angry. Yeah, I completely agree with that. The only thing that you said that I had some trouble with is this idea that there doesn't need to be a social change because I think it might cause a social change, but the reasons why the mother has this trauma in a particular way and the reasons why the mother might be reproducing the trauma are all socially conditioned. You're never acting in just a bubble.
No, absolutely not. But it's a question of not mistaking the chicken for the egg or the cause for the effect, isn't it? So what Damaris is saying is that it's not that social institutions cause child abuse, but the reverse.
Right.
So, but at this point, we can't separate the chicken from the egg, and that's the question.
Right.
But that it's not enough just to change the social institutions and hope that people will go along with that.
Well, you won't change them. If you just focus on the social institutions, they actually won't change.
The difference is that because of this dynamic whereby we create these groups and these institutions to act out our unconscious, that's always going to be the case. In other words, the only place that real change can occur, coming down to cliche, unfortunately, but is within the individual.
Right.
And this is, we could bring this back to the alien, because this is one of the things that confounds people about these apparent alien encounters is that they're not, whatever it isn't approaching us collectively, it's approaching us as individuals.
Yeah. Well, it has to, any kind of social change would have to happen within individuals. But those individuals themselves would have to change and see the social reality as something other.
They would see it differently, but they wouldn't necessarily have to go out and try and change it, because I think just seeing things differently does bring about change. Like if there's a pickpocket in the crowd and you see him picking somebody's pocket, you don't necessarily have to go over and tap your finger on his shoulder. It could be that he looks around, he sees that he's been seen, or it could even be that he just feels that he's been seen. I think just the act of seeing kind of naturally exposes things.
Yeah, I think that we don't know what we have seen, though, always. You know, that we've all, I think this kind of, you know, we don't always know what we know. So we have to make it clear that it has been seen. We have to act as though it's being seen in some way,
rather than suppress it and pretend we haven't seen it. Absolutely.
So that, and that may very well mean that we have to struggle for some sort of different society if we see this one is broken, or see what's wrong with it. You know, it may be that a woman who's living in a slum where the landlord is trying to kick her out and she can't find a good job will have to, in order to change the way she behaves towards her kids, struggle for with other people to change her circumstances at the same time.
I think it does naturally come about, but I also think there's this tendency, I think it comes back to that child, those childhood experiences where we feel we have to determine good from bad and make that split. So then this, back to this religious idea, that the idea that God is watching us seems to be inseparable from the idea that God is judging us.
Yeah.
And that's probably a fundamental error. That's probably not quite the right word for it, but that just confuses the whole thing, because then you have devout religious people who just live lives that they, you know, that they feel comfortable as God is watching them, and then you have atheists who just reject the idea out of hand and want to become their own judges. But what about the idea that there is a God that's watching everything we do, within or without, but doesn't really have anything to say about it?
The unconscious God.
Well, not necessarily unconscious, and not indifferent either, but just entirely tolerant, indulgent God, just interested and amused by everything.
Well, I don't know what to make of that God. I have to think about that. But what I want is a God who doesn't... like a God who will not believe in himself, maybe, or like a God that doesn't have a God watching him, you know, because basically a God that recognizes the contradiction that is inherent to the idea of God. Because, you know, anytime you posit some ultimate power, the question is like, could God make a rock that was so big and so heavy that he couldn't move it? And if he could, then he's not omnipotent, because he can't move it. And if he can't, he's not omnipotent either. So there's something wrong with the idea of God. There's some sort of contradiction involved with it. But then we've already discovered in this conversation that existence itself seems to have some sort of contradiction in it. So I just keep wanting to go back to that, to this idea that there's some sort of knot, there's something knotty about, and you can say it, you know, maybe, you know, naughty, K-N-O-T-T-Y, but also naughty, N-A-U-G-H-T-Y, about being alive, and that being experiencing things, and that we have to kind of look that in the face. Like, I believe, I'm someone who believes in original sin without believing in God, basically, or tries to.
What's that useful for?
Well, because it's back to this thing of, like, you know, you are not, you're not going to ever be able to get it completely right. You're split. There's a split. There's a contradiction. It's not happening because there is somebody who does have it all together.
Right.
You know, it's just like, yeah, this is split, and you have to work your way out through this problem, rather than say turn to the perfection and say, oh, I'll just get I'll just get some of this.
Well, yeah, it's a kind of paradox or a conundrum, isn't it? Because a dissatisfaction creates a sense of being wrong in some way, and so we want to get it right. But if there wasn't the idea of a right way, then maybe we wouldn't be dissatisfied to begin with.
Right. But if we weren't dissatisfied, then how would... I mean, basically, what would we be? You know? It seems like...
Without dissatisfaction.
Right. It seems like we need this dissatisfaction.
I think it's a habit. I really do. I mean, I think something like you're saying that the original sense of self comes about through trauma, so I would say original trauma rather than original sin, and so we identify a sense of existence with that dissatisfaction. But I think it's kind of it's more than a habit, but I think it's similar to a habit in the sense that as adults we've had this fear embedded into us that if we become satisfied we'll cease to function in some way.
Oh yeah, well, and lately I've noticed that I don't write as much as I want to. that it seems
so. Then you become dissatisfied,
right? Well, not only that, but that I have this idea that I would like to write enough stories that if I sold them all, that I could, you know, replace some of my income with it. Say, and the thing is, as soon as I really get that idea, I stop writing for a while.
Oh.
And the fact that my book is coming out soon is making me stressed and kind of putting me into a crisis. It's like, as I said this before, I think last time we spoke, that you get a certain amount of comfort out of having the same problem over and over again. Like if I didn't have this particular problem, yeah, I would
absolutely.
I would stop existing. So you protect the problem,
yeah.
You know, and I'm.
Yeah, that's like internal identity politics.
No. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And my wife just climbed through the window.
Oh,
she was knocking at the door, and I was ignoring it.
Okay, I suppose we should go, because my kid wants me to leave and pay attention to him, and you've got a wife climbing in the window.
We will be the masters of our bodies. But I have a feeling, for a lot of people, the darkness I experienced on that night is going to be what they see of the change. And frankly, I think there's going to be a total breakdown of economic structures. I think that a lot of people are going to go mad. I think with fear. We will be the masters of our bodies. Ecstasy is an extraordinary journey because it has no end. Evil has an end. Cold comes to an absolute end. Has an end. Cold comes to an absolute end. This is what the shock of contact is about. Well, you know, I don't think that when they travel through the universe, that they necessarily use any kind of physical conveyance at all. I don't think there are necessarily any gigantic starships out there. I think that gaining command of your materiality is the beginning of becoming a real starship. I think you can go anywhere, essentially, in this universe and do anything and find out extraordinary things without that. I think you can go anywhere, essentially, in this universe and do anything and find out extraordinary things without that. We will be the masters of our bodies.